Ever lose your keys? Is that normal aging, dementia, or something else? Fear often stops us from asking for a simple checkup from the neck up. Knowing your numbers, blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol are common, but your cognitive numbers are also important, especially if you're age 65 or older. Better to act sooner rather than later if you want to maintain or enhance your brain's health. Hello, I'm Kevin, president of the Dementia Society of America, a national nonprofit organization. I'm excited to offer you a free guide filled with tips for better brain health and important facts about dementia, care planning, and much more. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Your brain will thank you.
You can stop the search for something intellectual and fulfilling. You've tuned into the diary of a bald man, and there is no going back. Let the moaning, groaning, and bitching begin in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Diary of a Bald Man. My name is Edith Waters, a voiceover provider, small business consultant, and trainer from Tucson, Arizona. Today, Alan and I are hoping to entertain you with today's episode covering society and culture. All of the questions that you hear come from listeners from all over the globe, as they help us to look into the background of Alan as we look into his past and current views on life and mindset. Please understand that this show is for entertainment and contains explicit language and personal opinions held by Alan. If you are easily offended by a speaker that says what's on their mind with no filter, then this is not a show for you. So you will need to take your bitch ass somewhere else and find what makes you happy in that imaginary.
Damn, Edith, are you okay? It sounds like somebody may have pissed on your microphone this morning. And I hope that's not the case. You know, this show's going really well. We were looking at the analytics earlier, and it seems to be really, really going into an upward direction for us. What's going on, if you don't mind me asking?
It's not that. It's just been challenging with a husband and kids all being sick, and it seems that every damn time I'm out driving lately, some asshole in a Prius is behind me trying to give my Bronco a colonoscopy. Then, to top it off, it infuriates me that back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, young men would lie about their age in order to join the military and go into combat with their friends and family. And now they lie about gender to compete in women's sports or go into their bathrooms and dressing areas. I worry about my sons with the bullshit they are surrounded by in today's society.
Yeah, that's no joke. You know, it seems to be affecting a lot of people. And there's a huge concern about how, you know, our generations are changing, you know, Gen Y, Gen Z, Gen X, and things of that nature. I wonder what's going to happen when we get to the generation that's going to have a complete reset, you know. So I'm glad that today we're looking at societies and cultures, because when we look at that, you know, everything about our culture, everything about our society, it's created by our environment, be it people, weather, the ground itself, the traffic, things like that. That's what creates us. So something created that need for guys to want to join into female competitions or state this. And I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. I'm sure damn could have something into this about the mentality. But you got to remember, too, your mental anguish, your mental happiness and everything, it's not just internal. It's what's around you and what builds you, the things that just make you who you are. If you want, we can take this offline later and maybe get a hold of Daniel. And I think it would make me a good show where the three of us possibly, you know, ask somebody else to come online and give their input as well as to why they think current trends or patterns are evolving and developing. Just let me know and we could do that.
I am good. It is just the constant hammering of this idiocy on social media, including all the bitching and whining by persons in the entertainment industry over President Trump. And how if you, when they are leaving, just fucking leave already, and the rest of you stop posting their crap and keeping them in the limelight, Okay, ran over for the moment. Let's get the wheels on this show and start the Q&A. The first question comes from our co-host, Daniel. Alan, how did the customs and traditions vary between the places you lived, especially on Guam, the Philippines, and Hawaii?
It's amazing how many people ask that kind of question, especially recently when I was in the Marshall Islands. A lot of the workers that came out to Kwajalein from Ibai, you know, and I'd know some of the Tagalog words and things because of being in the Philippines, having Tagalog and Filipino friends. But, you know, it's not something a lot of people really look into because if they haven't traveled there. But if you want to look at some of the common things, yeah, common is going to be hospitality, 100% hospitality. When you're looking at different things, like in the Philippines and on Guam, we had fiestas. We had celebratory feasts, with, you know, and the hospitality was amazing. But in Hawaii, they call it a luau. And they have very similar dishes, too. So you could go into Guam and order pancit. You could order lumpia. Same things that you get in the Philippines because somehow it crossed over the ocean, you know, and a lot of it probably during World War II occurred when the Japanese were occupying, people were fleeing, things like that. But one of the chamorro dishes that I really loved was called kelaguin. In Philippines, it's called ceviche. But in Hawaii, it would be poke, which is poke salad. So the cultures are quite fascinating, you know, because like in the Philippines, they have a different society and culture because it's a much larger island than, say, Guam or the Hawaii. Hawaii has a spread of islands, but each island, Maui, Oahu, all them, they're going to have a different culture there too because of the impact of the environment, the people that went out there, the Spaniards, the British. So they have a lot of commonalities, even for being spread all over the Pacific Ocean, the distances. You'll see very similar stuff. Like you could go to the PCC or the Polynesian Cultural Center in Hawaii and see where a lot of it's brought together. Some of the traditional garb and clothing and attire made from vegetation, crafts, things like that, fishing methods, boats, navigating tools. So there's a lot to it. The similarities will surprise you. Very hospitable, feasting and food traditions. They all have a great and deep respect for nature. Excuse me, for nature. I was trying not to sneeze. Fishing is a huge way of life out there. But festivals, religious celebrations, you know, there's a lot of Christianity out there. But when you're looking at the Philippines and Guam, they have a lot of representation of Catholic patron saints. And Hawaii has Christian holidays, but with native traditions involved. You know, it's really neat wherever you go. The one thing about the Philippines, again, very religious people, but scared the absolute shit out of me during Easter was when locals were being nailed to the cross, self-flagellating, crawling on rocks and glass to be pious. But it's amazing. There was so much in the way that, you know, they celebrate and they put their hearts and souls into it. And the language and oral traditions are the same too in a lot. They'll do storytelling as a vital cultural tradition to keep the history alive. Tattoos and body art, you know, are starting to become more and more. They've already had them, but it's more prevalent in today. You know, it's something to think about unless you've had the opportunity to travel to the islands, see some of the influences by the Spanish, you know, the things like that, the foods, the way they're prepared. Similar, you know, questions like I had from the guys on the Marshall Islands, like they were surprised, like in the Philippines and different places that they could grow rice, you know, because they don't have the swamp or the environment in order to do that. They're basically living on top of coral reefs, you know, but they try to keep it going. It's a great question. So you'll see a lot of similarities, just like if you're here in the continental United States, you drive from one state to another, and you see how the state close to one another, their traditions, their foods, cultures, things that they do, they kind of blend into each other, but they have a different take on it based on hey, this group originally came from Germany. This group originally came from Czechoslovakia. Then you had the Portuguese. Then you had that. So it's a constant melting pot. And the same thing is occurring out in the Pacific. You know, they had the Japanese influence during World War II in the Philippines and on Guam. Not so much in Hawaii because of the Americans that were there at the time. But a lot of shared things. Anywhere in the Marianas, you could go through Polynesia, Micronesia, have a lot of shared traditions and customs. Great question. Daniel, I hope that helps. There's just so much more when you talk about these three locations. Good question. What do we have next, Miss Edith?
I'm going to follow up Daniel's question with one of my own. So Alan Edith from Tucson, Arizona wants to ask, what did you do to prepare for moving to an area with culture?
I like that question, Edith. You know, in retrospect, in 73, 74, the first time we went overseas to the Philippines, I really didn't have the intellectual capabilities to, you know, be forward thinking and looking into books or research of the areas we were going into. I knew we were going to the Philippines. I knew Deb was going to Clark Air Base. Had no idea about the names of the towns, cities, or villages in and around it. And again, didn't have the intellectual capabilities at that time to really study up on it. You know, I was like fourth grade getting over. So basically, it was immersion. We got there. We got to the location we were moving into and our neighbors and being curious. That's what really helped us to, you know, get into the culture of the Philippines. By not having anything or forward knowledge, you kind of absorb really quickly, like customs, courtesies, things like salamopo, to say thank you, little things, ende, yes and no. But as I got older, 75, 76 timeline, 76, 77, and getting ready to go to Guam, Dad had a group of Encyclopedia Britannica. And we researched it. You know, we looked at customs, culture, agriculture, common languages, the development of Guam from, you know, the Spaniards and the people that were originally out there. And then, you know, later on, Wikipedia came out. So if I was getting ready to go to a location, I'd bring up citydata.com, Wikipedia, other things, because I'd want to know about the customs and cultures, towns and cities of states that I was going to. I looked up the history of Shemya when I was going out to Shemya, Wake Island when I was going out there, Marshall Islands, you know, learning about the Marshallese and some of the customs and courtesies. So a lot of that came from research. I mean, most recently came from research that you'd find online. Previously, it was all in the books, you know, an Encyclopedia Britannica back in 75, 76. That was the best way to prepare. It didn't help with language skills like you do now with Babbel and all these different things, but it did give you some good insight as to the overall culture, how society was, you know, names, locations, villages of importance, impact by the Japanese community during World War II, and how it developed after that. Good question. I appreciate that. What have you got next, ma'am?
I know before moving to Tucson, I looked at every available online resource into the local schools, hospitals, community events, and some history of the area to prepare my sons for our transition from New Jersey. Our next question comes from Troy in Moses Lake, Washington. Alan, as a Navy veteran myself, I too have traveled through numerous areas. In your opinion, what is something you feel that the U.S. has provided to other cultures or expanded on in society?
That one's going to be really easy. The number one thing that we have provided to other countries, type 2 diabetes. We also have the highest number of banned items to be sold in other countries for simple things such as like GMO products are banned throughout Europe. When we look at chemical additives such as food dyes, red 40, yellow 5, and preservatives, you know, a lot of these things are just absolutely prohibited in other countries. Give you a good example. Mountain Dew contains brominated vegetable oils, or BVO, which is banned in the European Union and in Japan due to health concerns, you know, with bromine. Then you got to look at some of the other stuff where we're using artificial sweeteners, such as like hell, aspartame, you know, what being one of the biggest ones, because the body can't absorb it. What happens is, because with sugar, your insulin responds to it, but with things like aspartame, you know, your body can't digest it. Your insulin can't respond to it. So it builds those little tires you see around people getting a 42-inch Big Gulp. And that's about it. I mean, culturally, we've not been around long. We're a melting pot for other cultures and societies. So hands down, it's our shit food and our, you know, inability to produce things without destroying it chemically. Look at vapes. Look at stuff like that. Look at things that are banned. Ritz crackers, Skittles, and other candies because of dyes. Kraft mac and cheese due to food coloring. But Ritz crackers just because of the partially hydrogenated oils in some of the formulations are banned in some of the countries.
Okay, I was not prepared for a response like that at all. I thought we would have had some type of positive influence in the arts, cuisine, and literature.
Well, that would be great, except it's not true. You have to remember that most of our brilliant minds, both in the medical and scientific fields, come into the U.S. under H-1B visa. I mean, we're just not generating shit like we used to with the brilliant minds like Mark Twain, you know, on all of his literary stuff. Just being one of them, Ernest Hemingway, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, Stephen King, great minds, great artists. You know, Stephen King had movies made as well. F. Scott Fitzgerald, Andy Warhol, you know, there's just no end of what we've got in some talents. But look what's going on with our talents right now. They're fleeing the country because they said President Trump is going to get in here and fuck things up. And, it's just over stupid shit. You know, look at our artists now. Everybody is going into seclusion and isolation because of all the things alleged to happen with P. Diddy. So, no, what the fuck have we got to brag about except for some of our writers? Even, you know, the great chef Anthony Bourdain absolutely loved him, you know, and he's still loved globally. But it's the ones that are dead that people are going to remember. We don't have shit that we're projecting now in a positive light. Type 2 diabetes and chemical foods that no other fucking country wants. But we suck it up because they drop the price on it. And it's like, come on, fatty, suck another fucking one down. You know, I wish we did have more, but no. All of our great minds in recent history come in under visas. Both in your medical, your scientific, mathematical. And we're talking India, China, Germany, UK, Iran, Russia, South Korea, Israel. You know, Canada is even sending people. Mexico and Latin America, because of medical innovation for infectious diseases. You know, they were down there giving their people ivermectin when other people were trying to ban it and saving lives. Yeah, we got some stupid motherfuckers here. And we have some great geniuses not yet evolved because they can't get their head out of the PlayStation. What's your next question? This one's just starting to piss me off.
Alrighty then, let's look at this request from Howard out of Roanoke, Virginia. Alan, how did the sense of community differ between the islands and the continental United States?
I like that. That's a good question. So in my personal view, when we're looking at community, you know, we're thinking about overseas, you're talking about small villages or small towns. Cities are completely different. But the way I want to think about it comparatively, I know up in the north northeastern area of the United States, I've got a lot of friends up there and associates. They tell me about, you know, having like a neighborhood party or what they call block parties. They had the similar thing over in the Philippines, Guam. I don't know how it is now because you've got to think, Philippines, I was there in 74, 75. Guam was 77 through 85. Hawaii, you know, depending on when I was on island, Wake Island, it was a very small community on Wake Island. You know, it was all contractors and Thai workers. But the biggest changes in communities, over there, everything is community-based. You know, if you want to think about how good a community they were at the time I was there, think about what's going on in Asheville and Hendersonville. You know, once a disaster strikes, you have people coming from all over the island. You'd have, like in Talofofo, we'd have people come down from Dedido, Tamuning, Agatnya, coming up from Marizo and stuff. And they really went out there because you have family all over. The same is said for those locations. Like, you know, think about Japan. Every time they have a tsunami, People come from all over Japan to assist those areas. Same thing in Thailand, areas like that. So you have a strong sense of community. They're tied together both by religion, cultural differences, cultural similarities, family. To give you a good idea of the family type pack, think about your Latinos here in the United States and elsewhere. So the father, grandfather, whomever, builds a house, right? And then as new generations come in, they add on to it. So a big difference within the communities and the sense of responsibility. You know, the elders have the kids stay here. Here in the States, we push the fuckers out as soon as possible, right? Because they're not really contributing to the home, except in some areas. I'm not saying for all. I have seen in some rural locations where the kids stay in and help take care of the parents, take care of the grandparents. The parents help take care of the kids, and they pull their resources together so it's not such a financial impact on one. Latinos are famous for this. Just in Georgia, I remember two of my friends down in Gainesville. They had the entire family working at a poultry plant, one single poultry plant. And one of the reasons was they were respected in the community. They were respected by the people they worked for. And they basically built their own trailer park. So the aunties, the uncles, the brothers, sisters, everybody was there. And, you know, they may have like a two-generation, three-generation staying in one double wide, right? The elders would take care of the little ones while the younger ones would go to work, maintenance, poultry processing, you know, and it was a great dynamic. And I love going over when they invited me over for, you know, meals and things of that nature. Same thing would happen on Guam. The elders would stay home and watch the babies. You know, the younger ones would go to work. The kids would come in from school. They'd work on the gardens. They'd work out in the farm. And some of them worked on the same farm I did out in the boonies of Talofofo at the pineapple fields, stuff like that, the babulao. And we had pineapples and everything. So we'd take turns going out there, weeding, cultivating, doing all types of stuff. And that's the biggest thing. Out there, the family is huge. Here, it in some cases it is. You look at some of my Black friends, they have massive family reunions. They travel together. Yeah, they all have issues too. We always do. It could be an aunt and uncle, or excuse me, as Raven would say, auntie and uncle. But a strong sense of family. You know, not with everybody, even in the white communities. You don't have that, right? Because people don't want to get together for family reunions. They don't want to see so-and-so drunk or somebody so-and-so bitching about this or that. So community-wise, I would say the biggest differences are a stronger sense of community abroad. But like on Guam, which is a U.S. territory, you know, they'll get out and they have parades and things. And you have that in the smaller communities here, like here in Tennessee, Newmarket, Jefferson City. You know, they're very active in a lot of their community things. They'll do community potlucks. They'll do fundraisers and things that I'm used to seeing overseas and not so much here. But, you know, I haven't lived in every state. I've worked, traveled, been in some of them. And there may be some even stronger communities than I've seen overseas. But overseas, community-wise, stronger sense of family. You know, I wish we could see that even more. I really miss that because it was just something you got enjoyed. You went to a fiesta. Everybody pulled stuff together. And like I said, with Asheville and Hendersonville, you've got people from coming from all over CONUS or continental U.S. helping them. You got Shepherd's Purse, the Cajun Navy, you know, not even personally affected, but coming up to help those that are in need. Good question. Really, really good question. I appreciate that, Howard. And I hope that helps.
I can relate to that. Before our family left New Jersey, our local friends and neighbors came together for a block party like you mentioned. Not knowing when we would see each other again made that a happy memory for me and my family. Our next question, Alan, comes from Jeff in Manitoba, Canada, who asks, how have your experiences living in such diverse places shaped your identity or worldview?
I can't say any one particular place or location had a shape on my identity. I mean, everybody's going to view me as they view me, and it took a lifetime to develop that. Worldview, I got to see the impact in limited areas. You know, it was just what I was exposed to at the young ages I was there, and then some later. you know, the impact of religion, socioeconomics, the things, you know, created by a diverse culture and impact of other cultures into, I want to say, relatively small areas, but took generations for them to develop. You know, like I said, that with the U.S., we're a cornucopia. We've got Britain, we've got Latin American, we've got African, we've got all these different combinations that make up our culinary, our literature, our everything that's in society, everything, the way we drive, the way we interact with one another, you know, different terms and lingo and different linguistic things from one region to another. You've got the impact of the Amish communities on the farmlands. You got the impact of the Cajuns, you know, down in Louisiana, different skill sets. So it's a combination of everybody that dominated those locations and then try to coexist. So one of the benefits it gave me is I saw the difficulties in, you know, especially the Philippines, you know, different religions trying to cohabitate into a village, or on Guam, you know, the Catholics, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Baptists, all true believers in their faith. But, you know, it's kind of hard to celebrate certain things because Catholics do things one way. So what they do is, keeping religion in the mindset, they would change the way the fiesta was. It was still fiesta. It was a gathering. The way weddings were done, things of that nature, and trying to blend everything in so nobody was segregated because of any type of, you know, formal restriction by what their belief system was or what the elders said. So I've got a good understanding, and that helped, especially when I went to the Marshall Islands, you know, and I saw the people. Yeah, and you have to imagine, many, many, many of them were displaced when we did nuclear testing back in the 60s, 70s, and whatnot. So all these islands were impacted, and they would shift people from one island to another, you know, for safety reasons, things like that. But as some of the elders told me, they're so inbred now, because the bloodlines are very limited. You know, they were wanting the Filipinos and the Thais and other Micronesians to come in and help rebuild what they felt they were losing, their identity as members of the, you know, Marianas. It's hard when you look at it because you think a third world country because of limited infrastructure, limited medical, limited education opportunities, limited areas for them to grow and develop, you know. And one of the things I asked one of the elders, same thing when I was overseas, is like, on the island of Ibai, you know, you only have such a small area. Where are the graves? And all, he didn't say a word. He just pointed out to the ocean. So I'm assuming, and again, it's an assumption because I never saw one of the Marshallese funerals when I was out there, but some of them probably had to be buried at sea. I don't know. You know, some things they don't talk about. They hold that because they don't want you to think lesser of them because Americans are so opinionated. You know, and over there, it's like, you're gay, you're gay. You're straight, you're straight. Okay. You live your life. I'll support you, whatever. So I think that's the biggest thing, is being able to accept the fact that not everybody's going to be like us. You know, identity-wise, it just made me more open to going into other areas and accepting the people in those communities for who they had, or who they were, what they had, and what they had to offer, and then offering just as much as I received, because that's not something you see a lot of in the States. We generally want more than what we need, and then we struggle the rest of our lives trying to maintain, you know, that visual symbolism of wealth and status and things of that nature. And over there, they're just happy to be alive, make it from one day to another, take care of their families, be able to live in the cultures that they believe in, and enjoy nature as it is. Great question. I really like that, you know, and I wish more people could experience that. What do we have next, Miss Edith?
Our last question for today's session comes from Sergio in Eagle River, Alaska. Al and I, too, am a contractor and have been working on the slope for the past 18 years. How did the remoteness of Shemya Island affect access to fresh ingredients or influence meal preparation?
Sergio, that's a great question. I'm not exactly, I mean, I know a lot of people that worked on the slope and on the dew lines and things like that. But I would say it's a lot like what you guys had up there. Now, I don't know about when they have the ice roads come up, if they ship stuff inland that way, you know, going up through the BP roads and stuff like that. I know you probably get a lot of stuff airlifted just like we did. So it impacted us greatly. So the people in the culinary profession, you know, had to work a lot with logistics. And I know we'd get a good portion of products on, you know, barges, depending on schedule and availability and weather like that. But then weekly, when I was there, this is years ago. This is all the way from like 2007 to 2013. We get weekly flights of like, you know, fresh produce, milk, highly perishable items, lettuce, things of that nature. But I think they had to do quite a bit of advanced stuff, you know, probably maybe even a season ahead, because a lot of the stuff would have to come up from the continental U.S., out of Canada, things like that, you know, big shipping containers, things of that nature. So I can't even imagine the logistics behind it. Oh, I can, having been up there and, you know, seeing it on Wake Island, seeing it on Shemya. And I mean, that's just cool that you're even asking about Shemya. I didn't think that would show up as one of the questions I saw in the queue. But anyhow, so we'd get, I don't remember, I can't remember because it's been so long ago and things have changed, but we'd get maybe one or two barges a year, weekly flights, maybe bi-weekly, depending on the season. Weather conditions, availability, aircraft, things like that. So it had a huge impact. We didn't, you know, we didn't have any type of grocery stores or anything like that. 1,400 miles was the closest one that I know of. There may have been some on some of the other Aleutian Islands, small, like mom-pop stores. I'm sure on some of the ones with the fishing boats, you know, they had a good set of logistics to bring things in for the fishing crews. But it made it difficult. I mean, you know, some of my friends are out there would cook on the weekends, and so they would purchase from the dining hall, or, you know, as some people call it, the DFAC, items so that they could cook their own meals, you know, because we'd have phase one conditions. You couldn't walk outside. Winds would be 100 plus miles an hour. You know, so carrying, going over the dining hall without having your ass blown all over the island like a jet ski, it made it difficult. So we'd try and keep canned items, rice. I had a rice cooker. I'd keep things like that. But planning ahead would be very difficult. So I think they built from holidays, right? Get turkeys, get ham, get things like that. And depending on the time of year, try to put in maybe 2-3 months in advance, you know, requests for items, things like that, except for the perishables. But no, we ate well. I mean, we ate very well out there. I know they do on the slope as well. But if something happened, you know, with weather or stuff like that, we'd go down to soups and sandwiches, things of that nature. Didn't do it often. Not while I was there, the many years I was there. But yeah, it made it difficult at times. You know, people would get a taste for something, and they'd ask one of the cooks and say, hey, can you guys get this in and see if it's available? And they'd do the best they could to accommodate, because they knew if one person wanted, maybe a couple others would as well. Good question, Edith. I like that as a closing this one. There's so much more for society and culture. You know, like my favorite food is Thai and Latino food. I like spicy. So those were probably why my top two favorites. You know, the impact that the people on Guam, that was the longest culture I ever lived in. So you had a lot of Spanish, Japanese, Philippine influence. This show could go on for 2 days. I mean, just on the emphasis of society and culture. Our impact globally, again, diabetes, BAM foods, things like that. I wish we had more in the literary and the scientific areas. There's just so much more. You know, as we get into society and culture, it took hundreds of years to develop it. You can't just talk about it 30-40 minutes. I don't know. So Edith, take over. Let's go over what we're going to be doing for the next show. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and I'll close out as soon as Edith is done.
Alan, I enjoyed this segment and agree with your statement that 30 minutes is nowhere long enough to cover and discuss a topic like this for our listeners. I think that in 2025 that we should elaborate more on other areas after finding locations of interest and work with a team to bring those areas to life in the audio-only world. That's all I have other than to mention our next show is on what women want, according to your observations over the years. Thank you all for helping us to close out 2024, and I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Cheers.
Edith, before we go, I just want to thank you, all of our listeners, all of our supporters, everybody with the Revoicer and podcast team for taking part in 2024, and especially for all those who, you know, have reached out, provided us with their views, their opinions, their insights, helped spread the show to make the global podcast connection a reality, and for everything you guys have done. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I hope that you have a very Merry Christmas and an amazing New Year. As Edith said, our next show coming out is going to be called What Women Want. And it's kind of a parody, but it's also a view because guys don't know. Fuck, women don't know what the hell they want half the time. But we're going to have a lot of information that we're going to try and share, you know, based on observations with me growing up with numerous sisters, girlfriends, wives, friends, associates, people I know, and hopefully provide some males with maybe some comical and, you know, some really down-to-earth views on what we think that women of today want. And I'm not talking about, you know, guys that transitioned into women, but actual women. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Have a very Merry Christmas. Please think about, you know, those who are out there alone, maybe without family, without friends. And if that's you, reach out to us. We'll be glad to call. Think about the law enforcement, medical, people in, you know, social services, people in the food industry, and everybody trying to help and maintain the holidays by serving. Please be generous with your tone and your voice and your love, but also with empathy, you know, thinking about people that may not have what we have or what we've perceived to be the right way. Use love and empathy in everything you do. Thank you for listening. Plan, prepare, communicate, and engage for a better 2025. Now get the fuck out of here and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you for listening. God bless you. We'll see you next time.
Alan Wolford has produced this podcast for entertainment purposes. Neither this nor any other podcast he produced constitute legal, medical, marital, sexual, or professional advice. The opinions and views presented by Alan are his own and do not reflect the views or opinions of employers, clients, family, Facebook groupies, promotional sponsors, or baby Jesus. Any health information shared or mentioned as an alternative does not create any patient-physician relationship or other professional relationship between the audience and the presenters. No person listening to any podcast from this rocket surgeon should act or refrain from acting based on the content of a podcast without first seeking appropriate professional advice and or counseling. Nor shall the information be used to substitute for professional advice and counseling. As stated earlier, this show is for entertainment purposes, not how to lead or change your life. Do what is best for you or what your spouse approves of. Alan Wolford and all guests of the show expressly disclaim all liability relating to any actions taken or not taken based on any and all contents of this site.